next case, GLF Construction Corporation versus FedCon Joint Venture, case number 21-10668. And we have Mr. Thielheim as the attorney for the appellant, and then Mr. Auslander as the attorney for the appellee. If I have mispronounced any of your names, please correct me when you get up to the podium. Mr. Thielheim, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, and so whenever you are ready, you may proceed. Obviously, you all have been in this courtroom as we have had a little bit of feedback on the microphones. We're going to do the best we can. If the problems persist, we may need to take another break, but we're gonna try and muscle through.
May it please the court.
My name is Robert Thielheim, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants, FedCon Joint Venture, JT Construction Enterprise Corp., and David Boland, Inc. It's our position that the judgments against FedCon, and I'm going to refer to all of the appellants as FedCon on its breach of the 2.2 subcontract agreement should be reversed, and the corresponding or competing judgments in favor of GLF on their breach of contract claims for both the 2.2 subcontract and the 1.28 subcon should be reversed for the following reasons. First, the district court disregarded the express language of the 2.2 subcontract when it found that there was an improper termination of GLF by FedCon, even though FedCon failed to proceed as directed with the work.
Let me ask you a question. In your briefing, you resist the district court's conclusion about some of the work that was to be done by others of FedCon's subcontractors, the construction of the access road, the construction of the temporary flood protection, and the degrading of the levee and construction of the work platform. You resist the district court's conclusion that these were predecessor work activities, but in the parties' joint pretrial statement, you had stipulated that the access roads, the work platforms, the TFPs constituted predecessor work that you had to complete before GLF was able to move forward with their contractual responsibilities. Isn't that correct?
We had stipulated that they were predecessor activities, that based on the plan that had been submitted originally, those activities needed to be completed before GLF could perform its activities, but it certainly didn't. And what the district court seems to have misinterpreted, just in terms of a construction contract and the performance of complex construction contracts, is that not all predecessor activities had to be completed before GLF had to perform. It wasn't like the entire.
So construction of an access road that cranes need to be able to get on site. I guess I need you to help me through the problem with that the access road actually needed to be completed in a way where heavy cranes could use it.
Well, in terms of the termination issue, the issue that occurred was a differing site condition that required the work to be changed, which required the access roads to be modified and not alongside, as they originally planned to be, alongside or adjacent to the work platforms. That differing site condition, and no one disagrees that there was a differing site condition, that it restricted the workspace, that a change in the plan on how this project was going to unfold actually did occur. It was recognized by the Corp. The Corps said, please proceed, prepare a plan to FedCon, submit your proposals, and proceed with the work. This is all related to Workfront 2.
So tell me which provision exactly that you believe was violated here such that the district court's termination finding was incorrect.
Well, there's two.
Tell me number one.
Number one is the sequencing.
Right.
Is the sequencing, correct. Okay.
So this goes to Judge Branch's question, because I have the same exact question, which is, I agree with you completely in your interpretation of the contract. Your client had carte blanche to decide sequencing. But that legal conclusion is not the same as the factual conclusion the district court made, that you chose to sequence the work by sequencing the access road and the platform and the other predecessor work first before the other things were done. And she cited in support the same thing that Judge Branch just asked you about, which is paragraph 19 of the stipulation. This is docket entry 134 at page 17, which says, in accordance with FedCon's coordination and scheduling of the work, in other words, pursuant to our authority under the contract to be performed by subcontractors, construction of the access road, temporary flood protection, degrading of the levee, construction of the work platform, all of which was to be performed by our subcontractor, were predecessor work activities to GLF's performance.
Correct. But we could change that, and did with respect to the...
I understand, but counsel, the problem is, I know that's your position, that's your factual position, but you stipulated, and the district court relied on the stipulation, that in fact the way you sequenced it was the way that it's written here in paragraph 19 of the stipulation. I understand that you think you have other evidence. The April 16th letter says, work now, we'll fix the other stuff later, we've resequenced. But the district court, as a matter of fact, took that evidence, along with your stipulation, and made a finding. And that finding seems to be supported by the record, is it not?
It's supported by the stipulation in only the sense that the stipulation existed. But once you had a change condition, we had the ability to change all of the work. Your Honor, you
said it yourself. You recognized under Section 10.
Counsel, I agree that you had the ability to do it. But fast forward 3 years later at trial, you told the district court the way we exercised our authority under the contract was this. In accordance with that contract, we scheduled the work this way. Access roads, TFPs, degrading of the levee, construction of the work platform, all were to be predecessor work to the work of GLF.
And my client, FedCon, was not suggesting that they weren't going to provide access roads. They were changing where those access roads began and ended and how the access occurred. That was what was happening. They were changing it because the differing site condition required it, and we had the authority to do so. If at that point in time,
so that's not a sequencing issue. That's a separate issue.
It's a change issue.
Okay, so that goes
that's
to
why
10.
I said two.
That goes to 10B, right?
Correct.
Okay, so let's go to 10B because I know that's the second violation. So here's how I understand 10B. If the subcontractor, meaning GLF, makes a claim for alteration of work or costs or additional costs, they have to make that claim within 10 days of notice. And then if the parties disagree, then you can operate under paragraph 13. Is that a fair reading?
Yes.
Here's how I understand the facts. Correct me if I'm wrong. There's the April 16th letter where you say, get off the pot, let's go. April 11th letter, get off the pot, let's go. Here's what we are going to do. You guys need to go work. They come back and say, we need a change order. That's implicating 10B, that first sentence. We are asking for a change because we've been told that the work is now different. You come back with a change order, your client, comes back with a change order which says you get $0, you get nothing. Go. Isn't that a disagreement between the parties that then can go to paragraph 13?
It does go to paragraph 13, but the remainder of the change provision requires GLF, under those circumstances, to continue with the work
as changed. It's section 10B.
But it's the last sentence, I understand. But the district court found, and the evidence seems to support, that GLF said, we're ready to work. In fact, we were working on the other side of the levee, because there's the two sides. We're working in the 1.2 project. We're here. I got my idle team here ready to go. I got the equipment. I'm waiting for you to do the predecessor work that you now have stipulated needs to happen first.
That's not completely correct.
They
were not ready to go. They had demobilized in August of 2015 on that second work front.
Well, because of the weather, right?
Partly because of the weather, partly because there was a dispute over the change that was going to occur.
recognized a different site condition, and that led to a dispute between the parties.
But there was also predominantly weather that stopped it.
They demobilized.
All right, so the river goes down, the weather gets better, we're back in winter and springtime when the river is at a more normal pace. At that point, you say, here you need to go. They say the platform needs work. You guys get an engineering a site done. The Corps ends up agreeing that a change needs to be made and can be made. At that point, you say in April of 2016, go. Here's our plan. Go. Or commit to us to go. They say, fine. We need a change order. In other words, they went through that process. You came back and said, we're paying you nothing for the change. Why is that not exactly what 10B contemplates?
Well, first of all, in terms of paying you nothing, there is a zero on there, but there's also in the paragraph, in the change order, which is document entry 216-346, it says the contractor will provide the temporary work platform, etc. An equitable adjustment will be made to the subcontract agreement in accordance with paragraph 10. And there is actually no, when you read through the paragraph 10, both A and B, there's no actual requirement that the parties agree on a change order. The problem is when there is a dispute. We submitted a change order. They disputed the change order because they were upset about the zero.
Right.
We indicated.
So then they get to go to paragraph. Then they get to go to paragraph 13, right?
13, and 13 then says, nothing provided in this clause, which is directly, if the owner or the parties fail to agree upon the adjustment to be made, the dispute shall be determined as provided in paragraph 13, and then it says, but nothing provided in this clause shall excuse the subcontractor from proceeding with the prosecution of the work as changed or as directed or as required by the contractor. It gave us, FedCon, full authority. And just to make it clear what that truly meant, you go down to section 10E, which says all changes, additions, or reductions in the work ordered in writing by the contractor shall be deemed to be part of the work, capital W. That implicates section 6, which says we have the power to direct, sequence, all of the work.
Here's the only issue that I see, and I'm having trouble with, and I want you to answer. And that goes back to the stipulation, which says that you are going to complete
the predecessor work
that includes the revised platform before they put their crane on top of it. That's what the stipulation says. So, yes, you change the platform. It can be now 24 feet
as opposed to 30. I understand. It could be under different materials because you had to account for Chevron. But that had to be complete, according to the stipulation, before the cranes got on there, right?
It was the way the project was laid out originally, but the change in the work changed that. But let me also say that ultimately the direction to proceed in the April 11th and April 20th correspondence changed. And it changed significantly. At the end, FedCon, on May 23rd, sent a letter, which is at docket entry 219-883, and it's also acknowledged in the court's order, be advised that on this is their opportunity to cure. Be advised that unless GLF cures its default within 72 hours of receipt of this letter by providing a written plan demonstrating and committing to recommencement of the work. Set aside whether or not we changed it. All they needed was that written plan. They didn't do that. What they did is they responded with conditions. They did it all along. We will only agree if it's a mutually acceptable plan to us and a mutually accepted change order. They do not have that right under this contract. And that never changed. These provisions, Section 6, Section 10, the default provision which says if they fail to proceed as directed, none of that changes, and none of it's conditioned upon us performing any specific preconditioned work in any way, shape, or form, particularly when it came down to the cure provision at the end. All we needed was two things, a commitment to proceed. If they were going to condition that on someone needs to correct it, the work platform that's there that's not a full 30 feet, they could have said that. They could have said that, and they could have said, if you ask us to do it, it's going to be X dollars. If you're going to do it, tell us. They could have done that, but they didn't do that. They said, we want a full plan that we mutually agree with,
and a change order. They don't have that control under this contract. And the reason is it's a government contract and you're not allowed to have it. I need to try to reserve some of my time because I'm over it.
You'll have 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Auslander.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. Charles Auslander with Ira Libanoff on behalf of GLF Construction. So allow me, please, to start with that last counterfactual point that opposing counsel made. This was FedCon's work. The court is aware of the stipulation. The work that was to be done was to perform the preparatory site work activities that were literally necessary for GLF to do its work. And if you were to look at Exhibit A, which is part of the contract, you have, I think, letters A through H with subdivisions of the other work to be done by the other subcontractors in preparing the site.
But counsel, you push back in your brief on this notion that somehow they can decide the sequencing and change really just about anything they want in the contract, as long as it's a direction from the Corps. I have to say, I read the contract consistent with their reading in that way. But this seems to me to be not a legal issue, but a factual issue. What, as a matter of fact, did the district court find regarding the sequencing that actually happened, and what evidence supported that determination?
Fundamental point, Your Honor, because factually, and our brief says probably too many times for the court's reading, facts matter. Well, facts clearly do matter because all through this project, at every work front, and there were four divided two and two, at every work front, the work preceded by the preparatory, it's almost tautological, right? The preparatory work had to be done in sections, because the project inched forward, but the preparatory work had to be done before the construction of the new flood wall could possibly be done. And so that was clearly the factual record. But one point I want to bother Your Honor with when it comes to the sequencing issue is that the sequencing of the work was not really changed by FedCon. In other words, even in the infamous change order that they refer to, it says explicitly that they are going to do at the monolith sites the preparatory work as required by the Terracon report. Their engineer, who they hired, who came back and said, well, without 30-foot platforms, you better start engineering these work platforms because otherwise there's going to be, quote unquote, global stability failure. 200-ton cranes, a nearby petrochemical plant. It's a safety issue. And so even in that change order, the sequence doesn't change. The sequence is the same. And it makes sense. The preparatory work is going to precede the new flood wall construction. I mean, for me, this is a factually difficult to approach because I haven't spent much time walking along levees that are being constructed. Fair enough. But I have seen houses under construction, and I've seen and had battles between general contractors and, say, subcontractor electricians.
So if I could just fast forward us, because I know we have some other areas to get into. As I understand it, what you said factually is that the fact that every other portion of this project, both the 1.2 and the 2.2 contract, had a sequencing preceding access road platforms built first before GLF did its work, that's number one. And number two, in the April 11th letter itself, it also committed to doing the sequencing before we put the cranes on.
And in fact, the counterfactual point, which unfortunately I didn't effectively get to, that I wanted to start with, was that opposing counsel says, and they said it in their briefs, well, if you thought this was such a big deal, GLF, why didn't you do it yourself? And the answer to that is that FedCon is the general contractor, and they have to direct us to do that work. And that work is, number one, it's different. It requires different crews, different construction equipment, et cetera, to degrade the levee, to do the temporary flood protection for the property, to build the work platforms, to get the access roads in. That is distinct and different work. They never directed.
And FedCon had hired somebody to do it, correct?
Precisely. They hired another subcontractor to do it. And in fact, they never told that other subcontractor to follow the Terracon report. And so, effectively, Your Honor, to get back to your question, I don't think I answered it very well yet.
Well, I think you answered it fine.
The 2.2 work front was different, not in the nature of the sequencing of the work. It was different because there was a changed condition, the Chevron plant, FedCon. It was their responsibility to get an access plan. They could not get an access plan approved by the Corps. Then, as Your Honor mentioned, the rain comes in. And then after that, they do get the access plan approved, but the access plan includes that they're going to do the compacted engineered work platforms to avoid global stability failure.
So let me fast forward to a couple other issues I want to get with.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So you were awarded damages you were awarded damages for the termination. And that was pursuant to the contract that allowed for the costs that were associated with having done the work and any equipment and things that were put into it. As part of that, the district court awarded your client $880,000 for demobilization. That's correct. The term that's used by y'all. How is that supported by the provision in the damages provision in the contract for terminations of convenience?
Right, because it's effectively, and I can turn to the provision, but it talks about the reasonable value of the work performed. And in this.
Right, but how is demobilization the value of the work that was performed?
Well, first of all, it's effectively stipulated as we went through in the schedule of values that right at the outset of the contract that there's going to be a mobilization cost, there's going to be various work costs, and there's going to be demobilization.
Right, but counsel, necessary. Clearly going into the contract, you were going to be paid for it. But that's different and apart from the damages that you were entitled to under the contract, which only speaks to the reasonable value of what you did and the cost of any equipment and materials that are there.
Well, I'm trying to get to the provision because I don't think it's as precise as that with respect to that because.
Oh, I'm sure it's not exactly as I summarized it.
Well, I'm not expecting Your Honor to have it quoted, and I'm struggling to find it as well at the moment. To be paid that portion of the total price provided in the subcontract agreement that is equal to the reasonable value of the work performed.
Right.
It doesn't say the work completed, which is what FedCon wants to say, which, by the way.
Right, but how is taking equipment back to the leasing office part of the work that's been performed? That's not work.
Well, it is, but Your Honor, actually it is work because it isn't work in literally building the construction of the new flood wall, but it is work as it was defined in the values listing, etc. It is part of the work that is understood as the nature of doing the work. They want to
when you put out a contract bid, does it include in the contract price demobilization costs?
Absolutely. There's a stipulated amount in this case of the approximately $880,000. I apologize. I don't recall offhand precisely, but yes, it's part of what is the contracted to price, and it's reflected in that schedule of values. That is one of the things that we recite in the. I don't have the piece of paper up in front of me, but we recite that in the brief, and we and we reference it because it is part of the understood work that you have to get onto the site and you have to get off of the site.
So your argument would be that as we look to evaluate and the district court looked to evaluate what the reasonable value of the work performed, that is part of that are not only the mobilization costs but the demobilization costs.
Yes, it's the mobilization, it's the construction of the flood wall, and it's getting your stuff out of there. It's all
the
part
provision
of
limit you to those the reasonable value prior to termination.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Does the provision that we're talking about, which is 11B of the subcontract,
right,
does it not limit you to those things that we're discussing, the equal value, equal to the reasonable value of the work performed prior to the termination?
It does not. It doesn't expressly say.
Let me read the relevant provision here. It says, the subcontractor shall be entitled as its sole compensation to be paid that portion of the total price provided in the subcontract agreement that is equal to the reasonable value of the work performed, plus the reasonable value of properly authorized materials fabricated and properly stored by the subcontractor prior to the termination.
Right.
Is that not a temporal limitation on what we're talking about in terms of the reasonable value?
I actually don't see it as temporal, Your Honor. I see it as...
Well, prior is generally a temporal indication of when something happens, either before or afterwards, prior being before. And mobilization would, of course, did occur after termination, did it not?
Well, demobilization.
Demobilization.
Demobilization occurred after the wrongful termination.
That's right.
That's correct.
Right.
I mean, the permanent demobilization
right.
did. I'm looking for the word prior, Your Honor, in that sentence.
It's in the middle of the paragraph. It's so starting with the third line, the subcontractor shall be entitled, is what I read. And then if you go, I think it's four lines from there, it's the end of the, goes through the end of the sentence, by the subcontractor prior to the termination.
Right, but that last subclause refers to the materials that were fabricated and stored.
So that's your position, is that prior to the termination only applies to
sure.
properly authorized materials and properly stored the subcontractor.
And I think that's a very reasonable reading, particularly when you're looking at overall Florida law here, which is going to look at what was the reasonable value of the work performed. And effectively, the parties in that schedule of values stipulate that the reasonable value of the work includes getting onto the property, doing the work, and getting off of the property.
Where is that stipulation?
It's not in the joint stipulation,
right.
But it's in the schedule of values, which we cite to.
Right, but that's not a stipulation. That's at the outset of the contract. Here's what we think we're going to be entitled to.
Right, but imagine the converse, Your Honor. Imagine if FedCon could decide to terminate at a point where they had to pay more for demobilization than for finishing the contract. Under Your Honor's particular proposal regarding 11...
Just asking questions, Mr. Auslander.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. That's why I suggested it was just a proposal. I know you're just questioning. The general contractor, the general contractor to the project, could always terminate in anticipation of saying, "I want to pay you less because I can avoid paying the demobilization expense." That
well, of course, there's good faith that's written into all of this. I doubt it could just terminate just to avoid that. But let me ask you about one other thing. So, in your cross appeal, you take the position that delay is different than
disruption. Yes,
and I think I agree with you in the abstract. In other words, if this were sort of a standard, what I'll call a standard delay provision, I think the case law has sort of developed a difference between those two.
Yes.
But this delay provision isn't just a delay provision. It includes a lot more than just delay, and it includes hindrance.
Well, the district court focused on the word hinder as well, and
it seems to be the broadest of the words.
Well, the dictionary definition... I was pleasantly surprised to see, really does link, in some of the cases we cited, links the word hinder with delay much more than it does with disruption. And they really are distinct concepts. And the district court was right that as to the access roads, there was delay, because there literally was delay caused by blockading the roads, et cetera. But the disruption concept is distinct, and in our position,
hindrance includes prevention. That's really what the district court found and said, and I think that's a fair reading of the word. And even if what FedCon did was preventing you from doing that, from performing, that seems to be what's covered by the contract language.
Well, and where I would come back to Your Honor about this is the seems to be comment, which I would suggest when you are actually going forward and preventing an award based upon what amounts to call it, for want of a better term, immunization from a chosen path of disruption, then the word should be carefully selected. And that's why we take the position that disruption is not within that subclause. On that basis, I would ask the court to affirm on the main appeal and to reverse and remand for a damages determination on the disruption issue as to the work platforms and the two work fronts. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Thielhelm, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Obviously briefly, to respond to the argument regarding termination, I would simply point out two things. In terms of the judge's ruling, the judge said that termination was improper despite the direction that was given to provide at the end, in terms of the cure, just the commitment that you will return to work. Nothing in terms of the concept of whether or not the work platform at Monolith 76, right, was a full 30 feet or not, precludes that recommitment. And FedCon refused to do it. It also refused to provide what it believed its cost would be in terms of proceeding forward with the plan that was proposed to address the change work. That it could not do. We had the power to direct them to do so, so that we could even comply with the direction from the Corps submit a plan.
Do you agree that the April plan required you to build the platform first before they started work?
Before they started work? I believe so, yes. Yes. But that's not the issue. The issue is putting together a recommitment so that you would come back to work. I would demobilize.
I think whether that's the issue is the issue.
Okay. In terms of demobilization, clearly, in terms of it being a temporal limitation, I think it's confirmed by even the last section, last sentence, rather, of 11B, which says, specifically, the contractor shall not be liable to the subcontractor for any other costs, nor any other prospective anticipated profits on the work not performed. And it doubles down on the prohibition. And in terms of on the cross appeal, just the concept that you now treat hindrance and delay the same is actually inconsistent with even the cases that were cited in their reply brief. They're not the same. Certainly acceleration was included in that list. Acceleration's not the same. Treating them all the same would mean that hindrance is just surplusage, at least in terms of delay. And thank you for Your Honor. We would ask for the reversals.
Thank you. We have your case under advisement, and we are in recess. Thank you.
All rise.